Was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump and visiting Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi Monday exchanged hugs as they met reporters at the White House following their first bilateral talks. Mr. Trump said U.S.-India ties have never been stronger.
During my campaign, I pledged that if elected, India would have a true friend in the White House. And that is now exactly what you have, a true friend.
That's how Mr. Trump characterized deepening security and economic ties with the world's largest democracy, but he also called on India to remove trade barriers.
I look forward to working with you, Mr. Prime Minister, to create jobs in our countries, to grow our economies, and to create a trading relationship that is fair and reciprocal.
Speaking through an interpreter, Mr. Modi insisted expanding economic ties are mutually beneficial.
The all-round or comprehensive economic growth and joint progress of both countries and both societies is the main objective for both the president and myself, and will remain so.
Mr. Modi said he's confident his vision of a new India, coupled with Mr. Trump's Make America Great Again campaign pledge, will add new dimensions to their cooperation. He also said both nations are committed to taking their strategic partnership to new heights. Swede Johan Gustafsson, held hostage by al-Qaeda militants in Mali for 6 years, was freed Monday and returned home. Gustafsson was abducted in Timbuktu, November 2011, along with two others, one from South Africa, the other from the Netherlands. Their captors demanded a $5 million ransom. Swedish authorities said his release was secured a few days ago, but would not comment on the ransom. The Dutchman was freed by French special forces in 2015, but the fate of the South African is unknown. This is VOA News. 61-year-old Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo, a prominent Chinese dissident imprisoned since 2009, has been granted medical parole for treatment of liver cancer. His lawyer said he was diagnosed last month. Liu is being treated at a Shenyang city hospital. Human Rights Watch China expert Sophie Richardson said she did not see this coming.
We all know that prison conditions in China, under the best of circumstances, are not conducive to fantastic health, but I don't think anybody had known just how sick he actually was.
A U.S. spokesperson called on China to release Liu and allow his wife, Liu Xia, under house arrest for 7 years, to see him. Liu has been serving an 11-year sentence for subversion for co-authoring the so-called Charter 08, a pro-reform document. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is said to be preparing Tuesday to declare China among the world's worst offenders in human trafficking. In a late Monday statement, the White House said it found potential evidence Syria is preparing another chemical weapons attack. It said such an attack would likely result in the mass murder of civilians. Presidential spokesman Sean Spicer cited activities similar to those that took place before an April chemical weapons attack that drew a U.S. retaliatory response involving a cruise missile strike on a Syrian airbase. Brazil's caretaker president, Michel Temer, has been charged with accepting bribes by the country's top federal prosecutor a year after assuming office after his predecessor, Dilma Rousseff, was impeached and removed. Inter-American Dialogue senior fellow Peter Hockham calls it a serious development.
It's part of an ongoing corruption investigation that has implicated one way or another a good share of Brazil's top politicians.
Mr. Temer allegedly took nearly $5 million in bribes from a top meat packer to resolve outstanding tax matters. In Colombia, leftist rebels have turned over nearly all their weapons as part of a ceasefire deal to end a half century of war. The UN said it received over 7,000 arms from members of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The U.S. Supreme Court will consider the case of President Trump's executive order restricting travel while allowing much of it to take effect. The ban temporarily halts travel from six mostly Muslim countries for 90 days and the nation's refugee program for 120 days to allow for security screening procedure revisions. Implementation had been blocked by lower courts. Justices did say it cannot be enforced against those having a credible claim of a relationship with a person or entity in the U.S. Simon Sandoval Moschenberg is director of the Immigrant Advocacy Program.
So there's some sort of obvious cases, right? Is people who are coming in on family petitions, or people who are coming in to work at a U.S. company, or people who are coming in to study at a U.S. university.
The travel order is expected to go into effect by Thursday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo is visiting Zambia, the third African leader to do so in a month's time.
What that demonstrates is that it dispelled successfully. There is no political crisis. If the Madagascar president thought that there was a crisis here, it wouldn't come. If President Akufo-Addo, who is from the opposition and he won elections, it wouldn't come.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. South Sudanese react to their government's decision to cancel this year's Independence Day festivities. We'll examine climate change and the risk of malaria returning to Ethiopia's highlands. And Zimbabwe authorities again arrest human rights activist Pastor Evan Mawarere.
Sometime in the afternoon on Monday, Pastor Mawarere was arrested while in prayer with University of Zimbabwe medical students who were peacefully protesting a rise in school fees.
Diwa Mavinga is the Southern Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, and we'll look at fashion and its impact on African development. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo arrived in Zambia last night on a four-day official visit. He is the third African leader to visit Zambia in a month's time, including the presidents of Rwanda and Madagascar. The visits come at a time that Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, is on trial for treason. And some Zambians say the visiting African leaders are encouraging the imprisonment of opposition leaders in the country. Zambian presidential spokesman Amos Chanda says the African leaders' visit dispels the falsehood that some Zambians are spreading on the social media that there is a political crisis in Zambia. Otherwise, he said, the leaders would not be visiting Zambia. Chanda says the purpose of the Ghanaian president's visit is to cement the economic and bilateral cooperation between Ghana and Zambia.
The purpose of the Ghanaian president, His Excellency Nana Akufo-Addo, is to cement and entrench the economic and bilateral cooperation between Ghana and Zambia. And in his own words, in private conversations with President Lungu, he said that he greatly admires the tremendous, remarkable progress Zambia has made in the socio-economic transformation, particularly in opening up the economy to transform it from a state commandist economy to an open market economy over the past 25 years. And also the remarkable progress that the country has made in terms of a democratic transformation, entrenching human rights, entrenching good governance, and the separation of powers between and among the three arms of government, parliament, the executive, and the judiciary.
Your president has hosted, let me say, if my count is correct now, three African leaders, Madagascar, Rwanda, and now the president of Ghana. Amos, there are some people who are saying, why are these leaders coming to your country when your president is imprisoning an opposition leader? They feel that these leaders are legitimizing what is happening in your country. And they think that these leaders should be very, very strong to impress upon your leader to release the opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema.
What that demonstrates is that it dispels successfully the falsehood that mischievous characters are spreading through, of course, social media, that Zambia is at the crossroads, that there is no political crisis. If the Madagascar president thought that there was a crisis here, it wouldn't come. If President Akufo-Addo, who is from the opposition and he won elections and is leading a democratic transition in Ghana, it wouldn't come. If that were not so, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would not be inviting President Lungu for a state visit, which he undertook recently. So what this demonstrates is that those countries believe in the democratic transition, democratic principles of this country. The arrest of an opposition leader, and I've always been emphasizing that being an opposition leader is not immunity to prosecution. If you're an opposition leader, and you molest a woman, you can't expect that you will not be arrested because you are an opposition leader. If you are an opposition leader and you commit a break-in into a private home, you can't say because I'm an opposition leader, you cannot be arrested. If you are an opposition leader and you drive straight into a motorcade of a president who is driving, whose motorcade is moving at 140 kilometers you are endangering the life of that person, you'll be arrested. There is a clear separation between an ordinary, sometimes ordinary pickpocket crime, ordinary criminal behavior, and political crimes. So when these presidents come, if President Akufo-Addo thought that there was no democratic dispensation in Zambia, he wouldn't come here. So this is an endorsement that a falsehood that is being peddled in foreign media is totally mischievous, and we don't lose sleep over that. And I can tell you, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, is about to reach a deal with Zambia in July, August. If they thought that there was a breach on democratic governance, they wouldn't be talking to us.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe authorities on Monday arrested human rights activist Pastor Evan Manwerere for joining University of Zimbabwe medical students to protest recent increase in fees. Pastor Manwerere participated in a nationwide protest last year, which brought the country to a standstill. The protests were against the deteriorating social and economic situation in Zimbabwe. Diwa Mavinga is the Southern Africa director at Human Rights Watch. He says Pastor Manwerere's arrest proves that human rights remains a problematic issue in Zimbabwe.
Sometime in the afternoon on Monday, Pastor Mawarine was arrested while in prayer with University of Zimbabwe medical students who were peacefully protesting a rise in school fees. So the police broke up the prayer meeting, arrested Pastor Mawarine and several other students and took them into custody. Immediately thereafter, the university authorities shut down the university and sent the remaining medical students home. So they were taken out of residence and not permitted to remain at the university because they were peacefully protesting a hike in fees by more than 100%.
The pastor has been in trouble with the Zimbabwean authorities. Do you think he's now a marked person, or do you think the government considers him to be a troublemaker?
Well, certainly the government of Zimbabwe considers Pastor Mawarire to be a troublemaker because he is speaking up for social justice and is standing with oppressed students and is calling for the government to be accountable to end corruption. So he is a marked person. He has a number of court cases pending before the courts, and his family is out of the country for fear of victimization. So he is someone who has had a brush with the authorities, but who has remained resolute in his call for justice.
As you mentioned, he was out of the country for fear of his life. Was there any arrangement made between himself and the government for him to come back to Zimbabwe in terms of what he could do in terms of advocating for human rights? Did he violate any agreement?
As far as we know, as human rights activists, he had not broken any laws of Zimbabwe. But on his return to Zimbabwe, he was arrested on arrival by the police on fabricated politically motivated charges of treason. So those charges, he still faces them before the court, but they are completely baseless. They are without any foundation. The simple truth is that he is being persecuted for doing his work of speaking out and calling on the government to be accountable and to end corruption, to ensure justice.
Do you know if the pastor has been released, say, on bail, or at the end of Monday, do you know if he was still in jail?
Yes, by the end of Monday, Pastor Mawarire was still in custody. He had been moved from Avondale Police Station to Harare Central Police Station, but he had not been released. We expect that if the police follow the law, then he should appear before the court within 48 hours of his arrest. But that has not yet happened.
Let me say that the registrar of the University of Zimbabwe said that some of the students were arrested because they threw stones at authorities.
What we know, and from the video footage that we have reviewed, that was not the case. In fact, the police used heavy-handed tactics to beat up students in an attempt to break up a peaceful demonstration. So the violence, as far as we could tell, was actually from the side of the police on the students.
Diwa Mavinga is the Southern Africa director at Human Rights Watch. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 27th, Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. South Sudanese are expressing mixed reactions to their government's decision to cancel this year's Independence Day celebrations. Last week, the government announced it was canceling plans to mark the country's sixth independence anniversary, which falls on July 9th due to the economic crisis in the country. Some welcome the decision, while others say celebrations should go on as planned to remind citizens of the hope all South Sudanese felt when their country officially seceded from Sudan. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Following a lengthy cabinet meeting on Friday, government spokesman Michael Makwe told reporters the government will not organize independence celebrations at a time when hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese don't have enough to eat.
We are not celebrating. We will observe the 9th July because our situation does not require us to celebrate at a time when there are people who are in need of these funds which we could have been spending on the celebration.
In each of the first 4 years of South Sudan's independence, the government spent about 10 million South Sudanese pounds to organize celebrations. Makwe did not disclose how much money the government had planned to use to organize this year's celebrations, but says the government will use any available funds to assist South Sudanese who are trying to return home.
The budget which was presented was high, and as such, the cabinet decided that instead of us using this money for celebrations, then we should use it for other things if that money is available.
John Jurchol, who studies natural resources at the University of Juba, says it is necessary for South Sudanese to celebrate their day of independence.
Government has to make sure this day is celebrated no matter what. Unless if they define it as security challenges, then this one citizen can stop, accept that. But it is necessary to celebrate that. I also urge the government to make sure if they didn't maybe celebrate this year, they have to make sure that next year it is celebrated.
Juba resident Jamal Nicola Lumaya says government officials could use the Independence Day to explain to the general public what they are doing to end the ongoing crisis so that people's hope in the future can be restored.
Why is that only the Independence Day that they mention of money, yet the Independence Day is only one day that will bring all the citizens together so that they also hear from the leaders the ongoing crisis, or what do the leaders want to tell us during that day, because that's the day that will bring us together.
Teacher Bidal Ernesto Stephen says the day reminds him how he felt when he voted for South Sudan to secede from Sudan. He says organizing an event to celebrate independence does not mean the government necessarily has to spend a lot of money.
Independence Day reminds me about the freedom I have already got, because when we were under the bondage of the Arabs, there are other things which they restrict us of. But when we are now under our control, you feel free. Sometimes you can do whatever you want because it is already your country. You have that zeal of doing anything. You can even enjoy that I'm already at home.
It's the second time in as many years that government officials cancelled independence celebrations, citing a lack of funds. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Ethiopia's highlands traditionally have a built-in protection for the people who live there. The elevation and the cool temperatures have meant that malaria, the deadly mosquito-borne illness, cannot be transmitted there. But climate change may be putting an end to that safeguard. A new study led by a researcher at the University of Maine found that since 1981, the elevation needed to protect people from malaria has risen by 100 meters. For the first time, people living in Ethiopia's highlands could be vulnerable to the disease. Salem Solomon reports.
Ethiopia's highlands traditionally have a built-in protection for the people who live there. A new study led by a researcher at the University of Maine found that since 1981, the elevation needed to protect people from malaria has risen by 100 meters. For the first time, people living in Ethiopia's highlands could be vulnerable to the disease. Bradfield Leon at Maine's Climate Change Institute and School of Earth and Climate Sciences said,
"Slowly happening is the conditions, at least in terms of temperature, that are suitable for malaria are slowly creeping up into higher elevations of, in this case, the Ethiopian highlands. But the same thing would be true in other highland locations throughout the tropics. It's slowly reaching into these higher elevations that previously did not see them. So it's sort of eroding this natural buffer or protection against malaria, in this case in the highlands of Ethiopia."
The two most common types of parasites that cause malaria in the region require consistent temperatures above 18 degrees Celsius and 15 degrees Celsius, respectively. Leon's study found that temperatures in the Horn of Africa are rising by an average of 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade due to climate change. He said this may not sound like a major change, but over the course of the years studied, between 1981 to 2014, more than 6 million people who once lived in areas protected from malaria may have lost that protection. Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, at 2,300 meters above sea level, still sits well above the threshold for malaria. Leon said the communities potentially at risk are at elevations between 1,200 and 1,700 meters. Still, he emphasized, this is simply a meteorological study. He has not seen evidence that people in the described areas actually contracted malaria. But the research is pointing out that it is possible.
It does not necessarily equate to that means these people therefore are going to get malaria. It just says that it's slowly enhancing the risk if we leave all other factors alone. I mean, the hope is through interventions and so forth that we can, in fact, eradicate malaria in this and other regions of the tropics.
In 2015, about 212 million people worldwide fell ill with malaria, and about 429,000 died, according to the World Health Organization. About 9/10 of the cases and deaths occurred in sub-Saharan Africa. Worldwide, about 214 million people fall ill with malaria each year, and 438,000 people die as a result, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The most vulnerable are children living in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm Salim Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
The African Development Bank has conducted a study on the fashion industry in Africa and how its value chain can better develop in African economies. The study, called Fashionomics Africa, led to the decision to launch an online platform that can help support producers and investors who are looking at the continent. Emanuela Gregorio, an economist at the African Development Bank, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the possibilities and challenges in developing the fashion industry from Abidjan to Addis Ababa.
There are initiatives such as incubators and the skills development initiatives, trade programs that support artisans that will connect them with international markets, a lot of fair trade, a lot of also many governments such as Ethiopia, Kenya, that are trying to set up active investment programs to develop competitiveness of the sector, to help local players across the value chain, because you have a value chain approach from farmers to, let's say, in this case, designers. This is a first of a kind. There is not such a platform on the continent, and we really, as the African Development Bank, we have a Pan-African approach to development issues.
Is the fashion economy in Africa growing?
Fashion economy is growing indeed, but it's still in a stage of infancy, let's say. No, we know that the sector is populated by close to 90% of micro, small, and medium enterprises because it's a growing industry. We know that based on our data, the African fashion industry could be worth 15.5 billion over the next 5 years. Still, Africa has only a small share of this global value, which is 1.3 billion. So how to capitalize on this huge pool of talent and creativity? Well, there is the need to have the right support from the government that, again, provide the right system of incentives by attracting foreign direct investment, such as you just mentioned before, the case of Ethiopia. There have been, in the past years, they have been able to attract big multinationals such as LVMH, the Swedish H&M, and also Primark and Tesco. They are all delocalizing the production in Ethiopia because the great opportunity that is given by the low cost of the workforce, the low cost of electricity, but as well as tax incentives, for example.
What are some of the obstacles to those working in fashion in Africa, specifically West Africa?
I can tell you about our recourse, no? Because this is also the knowledge that we developed through the study, and also because our bank is based here. And doing this comparative analysis, it came out clearly, no, compared to Ethiopia, that in Ethiopia you have more support, government support, really. No? They are very proactive. But what came out clearly is that really there is a lack of government support in our recourse, even though we see that they are starting to develop some national strategy to stimulate exports.
That was Emanuela Gregoria, an economist at the African Development Bank. She was speaking to Ricky Strike from Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. Researchers have identified a weakness in the malaria parasite that could halt mosquito-borne infection in its tracks, not only offering the possibility of a cure, but a way to interpret transmission, viewers Jessica Berman reports.
It's being called the malaria parasite's Achilles heel, a protein that the parasite, Plasmodium falciparum, uses to infect red blood cells. By blocking the protein called PFAP2I, the malaria parasite cannot enter the cells, where it replicates billions of times before bursting forth into the bloodstream. The hallmark symptoms of malaria, including high fever and chills, come in waves every 48 hours each time the parasite reproduces, halting the so-called invasion phase. According to lead researcher Manuel Yinas, could potentially stop the infection, offering a cure.
Invasion has been for a long time considered, you know, one of the key parasite-specific processes that, if inhibited, would then prevent the full-blown massive infections that one normally gets.
Yinas and colleagues at Pennsylvania State University have identified and characterized PFAP2I, finding that it regulates more than 150 parasitic genes, nearly 20% of which are known to be involved in red cell invasion. The findings are reported in the journal Cell Host and Microbe. For the past 50 years, Yinas says researchers have been trying to find a way to attack the invasion phase, typically with vaccines that harness the immune system. Because the parasite has dozens of mechanisms that pull it into red blood cells after attaching to their surface, Yinas says it's hard to raise an immune response to block them all. Yinas says a compound that interferes with the parasite's PFAP2I protein has the potential to stop invasion in a single action.
You will ultimately impact a very large number of genes that are involved in invasion, but you only need to target one protein specifically, and that's the AP2I protein, because if it doesn't function properly, it's never turning on this large set of invasion genes that are required for that process to actually ever occur.
Yinas says the next step is to actually develop a drug that targets the parasitic protein. In addition to a possible cure, an agent that blocks PFAP2I has the potential to break the transmission cycle, since there would be few, if any, daughter parasites in the bloodstream to infect biting mosquitoes. There are an estimated 212 million cases of malaria each year, and the disease kills 429,000 people, most of them young children, in sub-Saharan Africa. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very nice day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with the Voice of America director, Amanda Bennett, on her recent trip to Africa and VOA's Africa initiatives, including meeting with African government officials, affiliate executives, media members, journalism students, and the African youth.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African Beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.